He didn't sound very interested. I thought of all that Tanya and Katya had been through, of what we'd all been through in our disastrous efforts to save Tanya's life. I was upset, but his spoken English is limited and broken, and perhaps something was being lost in translation. I had last seen her shortly before her death, after her return from England, on one of my regular trips to Kiev. Katya, her mother, had brought her to see me all the way from her home in Horodok. She could just walk if somebody held her, and her faint, lopsided smile had returned. For the first few months after the operations, her face had been completely paralysed. This had left her at first not just unable to talk, but also with a face like a mask, so that it seemed she had no feelings at all. Even the most intense emotions were hidden, unless sometimes a tear rolled down her expressionless cheek. It is sad how easy it is to dismiss people with damaged or disfigured faces, to forget that the feelings behind their mask-like faces are no less intense than our own. Even then, a year after surgery, she was still unable to talk or to swallow, although she could now breathe without a tracheostomy tube in her throat. Katya had been with her in London throughout those endless 6 months, and when I had seen them off at Gatwick Airport, Katya had sworn to give me a present whenever we next met. She now came not just with Tanya, but with a large suitcase. This contained the family pig, which had been slaughtered in my honour and turned into dozens of long sausages. A few months later, Tanya was dead. She probably had died from a blocked shunt. After the catastrophic second operation on her brain tumour, I had had to insert an artificial drainage tube into her brain, and this might well have blocked, causing a fatal increase in the pressure inside her head. Living as she did, far away from modern medical facilities, it would have been impossible to deal with this. I will never know for certain what actually happened, nor will I ever know whether I had been right to uproot her from her home in impoverished rural Ukraine for so many months, and to operate on her in the way that I had done. For the first few years after Tanya's death, Katya would send me a Christmas card. Coming all the way from Horodok, it did not usually reach me until the end of January. I would put it up on my desk in my windowless office in the huge factory-like hospital where I work. I would leave it there for a few weeks as a sad reminder of Tanya, of surgical ambition and of my failure. Several years after Tanya's death, a documentary film about my work in Ukraine was being made, and I suggested that it should include a visit to see Katya. The film crew and I were driven in a minibus the 400 kilometres from Kiev to Horodok. It was in late winter, and much of the filming had gone on in deep snow and in temperatures of minus 17 degrees centigrade. But as we drove west, the snow faded away, and although all the rivers and lakes we passed were frozen solid, often with men fishing through holes sawn in the ice, there was a distinct feeling of spring in the air. I wanted very much to see Katya again. During the 6 months she and Tanya had been in London, I had come to feel very close to them, even though we had no language in common. I also felt very anxious, as I could not help but blame myself for Tanya's death. Horodok, as with so much of rural western Ukraine, was impoverished and depopulated. Since the fall of the Soviet Union, the economy had collapsed and most of the young people had left. There were the rust-coloured, derelict factories that are to be found all over Ukraine, and rubbish and broken machinery were scattered everywhere. Katya lived in a small brick-built house beside a muddy yard. When we arrived, she seemed as nervous as I was, although she was clearly very happy to see me. We waded across the mud and puddles to reach the little house, where there was an enormous meal laid out for us. We sat down with her family round the table as the film crew filmed us. I was so intensely moved to see Katya again that I could scarcely talk, and was quite unable to eat, much to Katya's distress. I managed to stumble through, giving a toast as we followed the Ukrainian tradition of proposing toasts with vodka, accompanied by short speeches. The following day, we went to visit Tanya's grave in the local cemetery. It was some miles away from Katya's house, standing on its own beside a wood. The road to it wound along country lanes, lined with bare winter trees, passing through battered and dishevelled villages, each with a pond frozen over with blue-grey ice, with geese and ducks standing at the edges. Orthodox cemeteries are wonderful places. The graves are decorated with dozens of brilliantly coloured artificial flowers, and the gravestones all have photographs behind glass or portraits etched in stone of the deceased. Everything was in perfect order, and in marked contrast to the dilapidated houses in the villages of the living, which we had passed through on our way to the cemetery. Tanya's grave had a 6-foot-high headstone, from which her carved face appeared, odd, perhaps, to Western eyes, but beautiful. The sun was shining, the artificial flowers glittered and shook in a light wind, and in the distance I could hear the chickens in the local village. The snow had melted, and only a little was left, showing up as white lines in the furrows of the ploughed field, which we had crossed to reach the cemetery. There was bird song everywhere. As the film crew set up their equipment, I wandered round the cemetery, looking at the gravestones and their portraits. Most of the people buried here would have lived through the most terrible times, the Civil War of the 1920s, the famine of the 1930s, though it had been worst in central Ukraine, Stalin's despotism and the unspeakable horrors of the Second World War. At least a quarter of the population of Ukraine died violently in the 20th century. I wanted to ask these dead faces what they had done during those years, and what compromises they must have made to survive, but it seemed to me that they looked back at me as though to say, "We are dead. You are still alive. And what are you doing with the time that you have left?" The film about Igor and me was a great success. It has been shown all over the world and won many awards. At the end of the film, I was shown standing in front of Tanya's grave. I was looking sad, not just because of Tanya's death, but because next to her grave, and unbeknown to any viewers, was her father's grave. He had gone to Poland a few months earlier to make some money as an agricultural labourer, since he and Katya were desperately poor. He had managed to earn $1,000 and was about to set out for home for Christmas when he was found murdered. The money had gone. I had wanted to see Katya, not just because of Tanya, but also because of her father's death. Life in Ukraine is not easy. Chapter 23. Tyrosine kinase, noun. An enzyme that acts as an on-off switch in many cellular functions. Drugs to reduce its activity, known as tyrosine kinase inhibitors, or TKIs, are used in the treatment of many cancers. "Are we quorate?" the chairman asked. A rapid head count showed that we were, so the meeting began. The chairman, after making a few brief jokes, got to the business of the meeting. "We have patient representatives from the support group for the technology we are discussing today," he said, looking towards three elderly grey-haired men who sat on one side of the hollow square of tables around which the technology appraisal committee was seated. "Welcome," he said, with an encouraging smile. "We have our clinical experts," he pointed to two grave-looking men next to the patient representatives, "and we have representatives from the company whose drug for this cancer we are considering," he continued in a slightly more formal voice, looking towards two anonymous-looking men in dark suits with large box files on the floor in front of them. They sat a few feet behind us, away from the tables. Mr. Marsh is the clinical lead and will tell us about the evidence for the effectiveness of the drug. But I thought we might first start with statements from the patient representatives. The first of the three elderly men cleared his throat a little nervously and with a sad and resigned expression delivered his statement.
"I was diagnosed with the cancer 2 years ago," he began, "and at the moment I'm in remission. I have been told that it's bound to start growing sooner or later, and the only possible treatment when that happens will be this new drug you are considering today."
As he spoke,